All right, let's begin. Good evening. So we're up to our Modern Jewish History Part 4 section. Tonight we're going to be discussing Zionism. Zionism as a political movement. Tonight's topic, like last week's, is a big one. Zionism is a word which has many, many meanings to many different people. And certainly in the 100 years plus since its introduction to us, two things have happened. Number one is it has become the central theme, component, element of Jewish history. You cannot discuss Jewish history from the beginning of the 1900s until now without the idea of Zionism and the state of Israel being in the center of the story of Jewish history. So it's an enormous part of the story. And number two, the word Zionism itself and its meaning has gone through many transformations and adjustments over the years. Today, if you look up Zionism, you'll have to deal with labor Zionism and liberal Zionism and revisionist Zionism and religious Zionism. You'll have to deal with practical and political Zionism, post-Zionist Zionism. It's become, as because it's so big, as we'll see, Mirtzah Hashem, God willing, tonight, bigger than a single definition. And as I mentioned last week, when you talk about the Dreyfus trial, there's so many different lenses through which you can look at it. To cover in an hour or so what this movement has meant to the Jewish people is impossible. So we're not going to cover all the different potential lenses. We're really going to be focused on its origins. And for that, understanding when and how it came about as laying the groundwork for the future state of Israel. Even that we're not going to cover in its entirety, but we'll do the best that we can. Let me just mention, as I said last week, you know, there's a publication called The Week, which I mentioned last week, which is, you know, gives you the facts of the events that happened, and then it tells you what the liberals said about it, what the conservatives said about it, and so you really get them. And I mentioned how much my family used to enjoy reading that in the States. So I just want to mention there's an anonymous donor, not anonymous to me, but on this forum, who after hearing me say that, presented my family with a Hanukkah gift. They did a little bit of research and they discovered you actually can get The Week here in Canada, and presented a Hanukkah. So I just want to thank publicly for that wonderful gift, paying attention to my words. And as we're talking about Zionism, I thought it was appropriate to mention that my family and I would also really like an apartment in Jerusalem. And there are still a few days left in Hanukkah. So just if anybody's listening and paying attention, I should at least just sort of mention that. Throw that out there. Okay. No, but I mentioned that just because there's so many different ways of looking at things. And so Zionism is going to be one of them. What I want you to do, what we're going to try to do tonight, is go back in time. We all have, if I were to stop and ask everyone to define Zionism, everybody would have a definition. Not only would everybody have a definition, but I imagine everybody who's listening to this particular lecture would wear the title Zionist very proudly. That has not been true throughout the century for all groups of Jews for different reasons. And what we need to do tonight is go back in time before any of us were around and understand the origins of this movement, what it was and what it wasn't, to really be able to then understand how things progressed from where it was. In the beginning of your sheet, if you look, I have a list here. How do you see the modern state of Israel, which is, of course, what was birthed by the Zionist movement? And I have a list of options, all of which are accurate, realistic, and authentic definitions that are used by Jews today, starting with the least favorable and moving its way towards the most. It's a satanic act. It's an act of whatever we would define as some devilish act, a horrible satanic act, the modern state of Israel. Or it's an anti-Jewish state. It is a regime which calls itself Israel, meaning it's an imposter. Calls itself Israel, but it's not really the nation of Israel. Or it's a state that happens to be ruled by Jews. Or it's capital S, the state of the Jewish people. Or the state of the redemption of the Jewish people. Not just the state of the Jews, it's the state of the redemption of the Jewish people. Or it's the pedestal of God's throne in the world. You want to find where is God's presence? That is this modern state of Israel, is the actual pedestal of God's throne in the world. You go through that list and think about where you would define, where in that list would you place your understanding of the modern state of Israel? And Today, all of those are expressed by various segments of the Jewish people. But let's go all the way back to the beginning. Let's start with a basic definition that's on your sheet. Zionism is, or was, let's start with was, I guess, in its origins, a political movement born in the late 1800s. Again, that's an important opening statement. It was a political movement born in the late 1800s under the leadership of Theodor Herzl, as we discussed last week, whose purpose was to establish a Jewish national homeland. And that phrase, again, is chosen specifically to establish a Jewish homeland, that we should be a place where Jews can go and call home. Now, as we spoke about last week, I'm just going to mention again briefly this week, the idea of the Jewish people's love of the land of Israel, that is a religious concept that was born with Avram Avinu, and loving the land, as the Ramban mentions, is a mitzvah upon all Jews to go and live in the land of Israel. We all need to love it and yearn to return home. That's part of being a religious Jew, is yearning for the return to our homeland. That's not on the table for discussion. Believing that now is the time to return, and this is the way that we're going to return, and how we're going to run that country, that's a different story than saying, in my heart, I love that land, view it as my home, and can't wait to get there. Taking steps to reestablish it, that is a matter of politics and theology and practical debate. Those are two separate discussions. And again, we are not discussing the intrinsic love, just the political movement to return and actually set up a Jewish state within that land. Now, why? Let's just put one more thing in historical context. We're going to be discussing the late 1800s, 1896 to the year 1907, that 10-year, that decade in the crossing over from 1896 to 1905, 1906, that area. It's important to note that historically speaking, now again, we sort of skipped over this because we're going to go back to it in a minute. You can't do Jewish history. It happens all at the same time in different parts of the world. What took place between 1881 and 1903, during the same time period, but really beginning 20 years prior and then ending right around the same time, is what's known as the First Aliyah, in which an estimated 25 to 35,000 Jews emigrated to the land of Israel, primarily from Eastern Europe, mostly religious Jews going for religious purposes. This was born a little bit out of the Chov of Eitz Zion. It was born out of the pogroms in Russia. We'll discuss this, God willing, in a future week. So during this time, there is already a movement of Jews, Eastern European Jews. We're now talking about Herzl in Western Europe, in Germany and in France. But in Eastern Europe, in Russia, there's already this movement, a pretty large movement, 25,000 Jews who on their own, mostly unorganized, a little bit organized through the Chov of Eitz Zion, mostly unorganized, pick themselves up and move to the land of Israel. That's already happening 15 years prior to Herzl's big idea of Zionism. So again, we haven't discussed that in depth, we'll get to that, but just the historical context to be aware that that is happening, and the Chov of Eitz Zion have been around for 30, 40 years. Why has there been no practical movement until Herzl's idea in 1896? Why haven't the Jews created this on their own, that they need this political movement called Zionism? So, well, there are two basic reasons for that. Number one, practicality. Wasn't an option. The Jews had been in exile, kicked out from one land to another land. The land of Palestine was inhospitable to settling. There was no economy to speak of. It was sparsely populated. Getting there was difficult, and the Jews weren't in a position. They had no money generally throughout most of their exile. We had periods of wealth certainly in Spain and in Portugal, even though that, of course, ended in disaster. It wasn't an option to organize the Jewish people to return back to the land. As much as we think of the media of the late 1800s as archaic, given what we're living in right now, but the idea of pamphlets and newspapers being as widespread as they were in the late 1800s was also something which got word out far faster than what could have happened in the 1600s, certainly. And as a result, practically speaking, it wasn't an option. Additionally, and possibly as importantly, until the late 1700s, there was no such thing as a secular Jew. There wasn't such a movement. The Reform movement hadn't started. The Enlightenment hadn't started. The Jews were, by and large, either religious Jews or they left Judaism, but they didn't identify as a secular Jewish person. That didn't really come about until the Enlightenment movement. The religious Jewish community had an idea very deeply ingrained, which I'm going to speak about as their opposition to this movement, of waiting for Mashiach, waiting for the Messiah, waiting for Hashem to come and take us back. I grew up personally with stories, and this is even way after Zionism, of the Chafetz Chaim sleeping with a suitcase packed under his bed. I remember that's how I grew up. Chafetz Chaim used to have a suitcase packed waiting for Mashiach to come and he'd be ready to go, pick up, and go to Israel. And that was the idea. We're waiting for Mashiach to come and take us home. That derives from a passage in the Talmud. The Gemara says there were actually three oaths. The Jewish people swore to upkeep three things. We're not going to get into the whole Gemara. It's not really not for our topic tonight. But the Gemara says one of them is that the Jewish people will not rise like a wall in their return to the land of Israel, which was generally interpreted throughout the centuries of we will not return in mass. We will wait for Hashem to bring us back. We swore that we would not rebel against the nations of the world which are hosting us, and that then God made the nations of the world swear not to overly subjugate us while we were in their lands. This passage of the Talmud is many, many interpretations and discussions, but there's a basic idea of we took an oath, we were sent into exile, and we'll wait there until we are brought out. So there really had been no major movement throughout, which is really unbelievable. For almost 2,000 years, the Jews simply went from exile to exile through problem and persecution and pogrom and inquisition from one to another, and never really organized into an idea of let's go home. It happened a little bit, we mentioned, after the Spanish Inquisition, where they were already exiled. Several thousand did make their way to Israel, but that also did not turn into any mass immigration. And we just, you know, kept on going on here in the exile. Zionism, modern Zionism, changes as we discussed last week at the end of the Dreyfus trial. In 1896, Theodor Herzl, who's really from Vienna, is stationed in Paris as the correspondent to a Viennese newspaper, and he witnesses the crowds shouting for the head of Dreyfus, as we discussed last week. He himself is a totally assimilated Hungarian Jew. His own son did not have a bris milah, certainly not a bar mitzvah, and he himself, who had been grappling with this Jewish problem of anti-Semitism, he himself had written that in his first attempt of a solution was mass baptism. Everybody should convert to Christianity. He would be first online, and that will solve our Jewish problem. After seeing what takes place with the Dreyfus trial, he publishes Der Judenstaat, which he writes in German, in which he has this epiphany: the only solution to the Jewish problem is a land of our own. We need to have a home, and that is the only way that we're ever going to solve this problem. Now, if in Paris he saw, which was the seat of liberty and equality, can still have such anti-Semitism, there's no other solution. What do we need to do? He said, we need to be normal. The problem is we're an abnormal people. We have no government. We have no autonomy. We have no flag. We have no Olympic team. That's the problem with the Jews. If we would only become normal like everybody else, they wouldn't hate us as much and we would be able to blend in. We've already assimilated, but we're there amongst them. We need to have our own nation. Now, parenthetically, I mentioned that there's no Olympic team. Just as a historical note, the first modern Olympics were recreated again in 1896, the same year that he publishes his book. It was in Athens with all of 14 nations and 241 athletes participated in the first Olympics in 1896. So we need to have a team. We need to have, we need to be normal. Now, one of the great ironies in all of modern Jewish history is that the founder of Zionism was trying to solve the Jewish problem of anti-Semitism in the modern world by creating a Jewish state, a Jewish homeland, and that would solve our problem. And we, who live 120 some odd years after this epiphany of Theodor Herzl, laugh at the ludicrous concept that, oh yeah, if the Jews would have their own state, there wouldn't be any anti-Semitism in the world because we would be normal like everybody else. The thought process of even hearing those words is so laughable to us, but that was the thinking of Herzl at the time. If only we could be like them, then our problems would be solved. Now, there are a number of important aspects of what he wrote in his book in great detail, how he envisioned this Jewish state would look. Now, there are a number of very important components to it. Number one, it did not need to be Palestine. That idea is a very obviously Jewish and religious idea that it's our homeland. Herzl was not returning home. Herzl was saying, we need our own home. Not go back, capital H, to our homeland. We just need a place. That's our own. We're going to see very famously later, of course, he accepts the proposal to go to Uganda because the land of Palestine wasn't relevant. It wasn't important. It was, we just need our own state. The language most certainly was never in his wildest dreams going to be Hebrew, which had not yet been brought back from the dead by Ben Yehuda. The language was going to be most likely German or French. He wrote his book in German, and he was going to model this new land after Venice. Rothschild was going to be his leader, he wrote. Formal dress would be required at all state functions, which he actually enforced at the first six Zionist congresses. You must have attended in formal attire. He was a German. He believed in what they were promoting in their kind. We were going to do it ourselves just in a Jewish land. And he describes these spacious cities, and we're going to transplant all the Jewish quarters from around the world, and we're going to rebuild them into this new state. There was nothing remotely religious at all in his vision. He was not familiar with religious Judaism. He was not familiar with practices. It just wasn't part of his world or part of his vision. And it wasn't actually called Zionism. That name, Zionism, was not given by Theodor Herzl himself. It was actually named by Nathan Birnbaum, another great irony of historical fact. A Jew by the name of Nathan Birnbaum named it in 1893, is 3 years before Herzl. He founded an organization called Kadima in 1883, 10 years prior to that, for Viennese students. Again, in 1881, we already have the first mass aliyah to the land of Israel. And he had this group for Jewish students in Vienna, and he coined the idea of Zionism, that name of the love of Zion. And his history seems to have been where he was not always observant, came from an observant home. He wasn't always himself. He came back to it. But at some point after the first Zionist Congress, he leaves Herzl. He was not taken by the vision that Herzl was promoting. And he eventually becomes Orthodox and he joins the Aguda. The Aguda, which is going to be the opposing movement to Zionism in the early 1900s. So this fellow, Nathan Birnbaum, who coins the phrase Zionism, joins the movement that's going to be most opposed to the Zionistic movement. But that's just an interesting historical note. In any case, when Herzl publishes this book, it just electrifies the Jewish world. It's as, almost as if you have this like haystack and a flame is thrown in which, after all the years, again, we're 20 years into the pogroms of Eastern Europe already, 1881. The Jews are already going there. All the problems of the 1800s, there's Chovevei Tzion. They were waiting for something to latch onto. And the publishing of this book by a totally irreligious secular Jew of a return home ignites the fire. And he has the ability to gather it together in his call for the first Congress. And he makes it happen. Completely makes it happen. Now, what happens is those who join in are a true mixed bag of Jews who join into this vision that he promotes. Now, no one is completely sure what exactly he's promoting. All it is, he published this little book about this fanciful dream of a new homeland, and he calls this verse Zionist Congress. And those who joined in were primarily three different types of Jews, strange bedfellows who join into the movement. Number one, you have religious Jews. I don't say number one, they were the majority. They were not the majority, but they were a noticeable group. They were primarily Eastern European, mostly religious. And they're inspired not at all like Herzl as simply a solution to a Jewish problem. They've been davening three times a year for the return home. And there's this spark that's brought into the world that's been simmering for 30, 40 years already of it's time to go back. It's time to come home. The time is now. And all of a sudden, there's this idea of the first Zionist Congress. And these Jews join in. Again, not in mass. They're not the majority. But there is a sizable number of religious Jews at first who join in to be part of this for religious reasons. Herzl was deprecatingly called them my army of schnurs. You know, these are my Eastern European Jews. They're the army of schnurs who are going to help us in our cause. The other major group were the Maskilim. We've spoken about the Maskilim, the enlightened Jews, also of Eastern Europe, as the enlightened movement and Western Europe, as the enlightened movement sweeps through. So now we have this secularized Jew who still identifies Jewish, but has become secular. He's no longer religious. He has become assimilated. He's part of culture, going to the universities. And this group of Maskilim, who had the Haskalah movement, really just morphs into the Zionist movement. They are determined to create a new cultural Jew. That's what they've been trying to do throughout Europe, fighting the shtetl, fighting the Beis HaMedrash, fighting all that the old guard represented. They wanted a new Jew. And this movement was it. This was their chance. We're going to go to a new land. We're going to recreate. We're going to start anew. And that was their vision. They join in the idea of Torah, mitzvah, Shabbos, Kashrus, God himself, not part of the program. We're going to create a new cultural Jew. We're going to leave behind 1,000 years of suffering in the exile, which was all because of being backwards and old-fashioned. We're going to move into the new era, enlightened, educated, and culturally new. Echad Ha'am, the pen name for Asher Ginzburg. They were interested in glorifying the chalutz and the kibbutz, a secularized Jew. Exile is negative. And the pictures, if you know, you can go back, you picture, you know, the old Jew was short, hunched over, big nose, long black coat, big hat, beard. All the Israeli pictures in the early 1900s, blonde hair, strong, shorts, t-shirt, you know, it's a whole new vision of what a Jew is going to look like. And that's the second group that join in this movement. And the third group are those who are really like Herzl and Max Nordau, who becomes the second leader after Herzl's death, which are agnostic atheists, the elite, sophisticated and assimilated. They're removed from Jewish tradition. The Maskilim, again, the early Maskilim were learned in Jewish traditions. The early Maskilim understood. They spoke Yiddish. They were steeped in Jewish tradition, even as they're throwing it up. They know it. They're familiar. And as much as they want to create a new Jew, you know, it's that bridge. And then you had a group of Jews already just totally unfamiliar with Jewish culture and customs, this elite, very often a wealthy group, and they all are part of this Zionist movement, and they all want something different from it as they join this first Zionist Congress that Herzl creates. Now, one of the first major conflicts within the Zionist, now we know you only needed two Jews to go to the Congress and you would have had major debates about what it should be and what it should become. We have hundreds of Jews showing up from many different camps. Obviously, they were not going to agree on how this was going to look and what shape it would take. There were the earliest major debates was on what exactly Zionism should represent. And there were two major schools of thought. One was called political Zionism, and one was called practical Zionism. Herzl was in the camp of political Zionism. What that meant was, again, he calls his first Congress in 1897 in Basel, Switzerland. By the way, why is it in Basel, Switzerland? Because he wanted it in Munich. He wanted it in Germany. But the Jews of those areas protested vehemently that it can't be here, because the reform movement had really taken hold in those areas, and this idea of risking our loyalty to the homeland, we can't have a Congress here that's all about leaving and setting up a new. They absolutely refused to allow him to have his Congress in those areas, and he ends up going to Basel, Switzerland, the neutral place, in order to be able to have this Congress. So Herzl believed in what was called political Zionism, which means the way that this is going to work is that we need to secure official government world permission. We need a charter, either from the British Empire or from the League of Nations, to create a state. And it's going to be political, with a stamp. We're going to be able to put a piece of paper up on the wall and say, we have permission from the nations of the world to create our own state. And therefore, all efforts and all monies have to be directed towards diplomacy to be able to achieve this permission. Practical Zionism, which will be later led by Ben-Gurion, for example, not at the time, he was born in 1886. He's all of 11 years old at the first Zionist Congress. He wasn't at the head of this movement, but he represents it later in life. Practical Zionism says, no. It doesn't matter what the Gentiles say. It only matters what the Jews do. And here you have these two approaches. One that says, we need their permission. We need them to like us. We need them to give us approval. And the other approach that says, we're going to do what we need to do, and we don't care what the nations of the world say. And these two thoughts, you might be familiar as I'm saying this, have continued until today, in which there are some streams of Jews who are very into getting official government position, whether it be from the States or from Europe or wherever, but it needs to be done with diplomacy. And those who say, do what you need to do and apologize later. We don't care what anybody else says, and we don't care if we need their permission or not. And these two, well, here it became a very practical issue of, if I have X amount of dollars, do I spend it on diplomacy, or do I spend it on developing the land? What should I do with the money? I can't do it all. And so the practical Zionist said, you know what, forget the nations of the world, just develop the land, populate the land, bring Jews in, create an infrastructure. We just need to go home and we'll be able to create our own state. We don't need the British to say yes. And the political Zionist is like, no, we do need the British to say yes. Now, in the end, of course, they're both right. Because what happens, as is often the case, whenever there's a debate, it's because both sides have truth to it. We just need to be able to see that just because I think like this and you think like that, maybe we need us both. That's the story of the Jewish people throughout history. Well, one day we'll figure it out that it's okay that other people think and do things differently than us. We need us all. This is a classic example because in 1948, the state of Israel is born with a vote in the United Nations, with the diplomatic declaration of independence, and it only was possible because there were already 600,000 Jews who moved, who developed the land, who created the infrastructure, who developed an army. You could have had a UN vote all you wanted, but if you don't have the Jews living there, and you don't have a Jewish agency, and you don't have an army, it wasn't going to work. So they both were true. You needed to develop both simultaneously, and eventually that's exactly what happened. So in 1897, he begins his official political Zionist movement. Again, his goal, we need a home. We need a place for Jews to be able to develop their own state and to begin the political mechanisms to put them into place to be able to do so. Now, as much as he electrified the Jewish world, as you can imagine, nothing happens in the Jewish world without opposition, and the opposition that he faced was fierce from amongst the Jews. Now again, you have to go back to the 1890s. You have to go back to the 1920s and the 1940s, pre-state. We live in an era where the state of Israel is a given in our life. It is a given to the degree we're now nearly, I think we're just at that line of half of world Jewish population has returned home. The state of Israel is state of the art. It's technologically advanced in agriculture, in military might. It is. Yeah, we to understand this is to go back where it's a desolate piece of land, Jews are trickling back, and all of a sudden now you have a movement, a political movement to stir up world Jewry, stir up anti-Semitism, which again, Herzl thought he was going to solve that problem, and start this movement back. So the opposition came from three major streams. The first was Reform Jewry. Reform Jewry had already taken quite a hold in Western Europe, and they were not interested at all in this idea. They already had completely erased Tzion Yerushalayim from their prayer books. They were into loyalty to their motherhood, their mother nation. And this idea of dual loyalty, which that phrase still comes up until today recently, is a major factor, a claim against a Jew in a foreign land, dual loyalty. You're not a real American. You're not a real Frenchman. You're loyal to Israel more than you're loyal to your country. There's a complicated issue for a religious Jew in today's day and age. Well, when this first got started, so the Reform movement looked at this and they said, we can't support a movement. We can't send our money to develop this land or our people. It goes against our patriotism, our being Germans, our being Frenchmen. That's what they wanted to be. And the Reform movement's relationship to the state of Israel was always colored by this. Even into the 1960s, many Reform congregations refused to appeal for Israel bonds because it just goes against the grain of what they believed in was where a Jew should be and how they should be living. The wealthy certainly saw this against their interests because it was a threat to their interests. Whenever there's a revolution, whenever there's something new, it shakes up the world order. So if you happen to be whatever the 1% we'll call them as they're known as, that's on top of that world, that 1% doesn't want the world order to be shaken up. They're doing just well as it is. That 1% might be a small percentage of the population, but it holds great power and great wealth. This idea of this electrifying movement to return Jews to the land of Israel and Palestine was very much going to shake up the world. And so this powerful elite assimilated group was not interested in all to protect their own personal business interests. Just to express this is a wonderful quote from Moritz Benedict, who was actually the owner of Herzl's own newspaper in Vienna. So he gets word, he sends Herzl off from Vienna to France, to Paris to cover the Dreyfus trial, and he comes back with a book about the Jewish state and the whole Jewish world is up in arms. He writes, quote, no individual has the right to take upon himself the tremendous moral responsibility of setting this avalanche in motion. How can you do this? You're going to literally set an avalanche. You can't do that. We shall lose our present country before we get a Jewish state. Now, it wasn't not an incorrect sentiment that says you're going to get us kicked out of all of our homelands way before you create a Jewish state. So how dare you take upon yourself to set this avalanche? What the damage you're going to do? It's interesting. In halacha, he's actually well-founded. The halacha is if you want to build a new shul, you're not allowed to destroy the old shul until you build the new one. First, build the new one. When it's up and done, then you can destroy the old one. But you're not allowed to destroy the old one to make room, because what's going to be in between? What if you run out of money? What if something happens? You have nothing. So you first build the new and then destroy the old. So he's making that argument of you're going to destroy our world order way before we have a place to go. That's one major form or source of opposition from the Reform. Then he gets another one from the Jewish left, the Bund and the communists, who were bitterly anti-religious. Now, the Jewish left, the Bund, the Communists, they are a powerful lobby. And even until the 1930s, they're still holding their banquets in Vienna on Kol Nidre nights, totally irreligious. And they philosophically hold there's no Jewish problem in the world. It's a world capitalist problem. That's the problem, the capitalists. And here we are, they say. Jews were the leaders of all of these movements, as you know. We're trying to save the entire world, and all of a sudden, this small band is focusing on a tiny piece of land to get a few million Jews there. We are trying to save the world from the capitalists, and you're ruining it by diverting attention. So they were opposed to this entire movement. They said, you jumped on the wrong movement. We're here to solve all of the world's problems. And of course, then what's relevant for us as well is the third place of opposition, which was the Orthodox world. The Torah world was, as a whole, very opposed to this movement. As I mentioned earlier, there were certainly religious Jews who joined in his movement, but Jewish leadership almost to a T did not. And there were some very, very strong reasons why in the early days the religious community was very opposed to this movement. Let's go through some of those. Number one, I'm on the top of page 3 if you're following along. Number one, and we mentioned this last week as well, it was difficult, if not impossible, to imagine that God was redeeming his people in this manner. It just is impossible. Here you have this anti-religious Jew, Herzl. Debatable whether he even married a Jew. He certainly did not have a Jewish wedding. His son doesn't have a bris. He is illiterate in Jewish custom and practice. We've been praying for Mashiach for 1,000, 2,000 years. It can't be that this is who God is sending us. That was just the sentiment of, there's no way that this is what's, he doesn't know our, he doesn't know the people, he doesn't know the customs, the laws, the values. It's impossible. Now, it also goes against these three oaths, which I mentioned briefly, of we so to speak, in the Talmud, took an oath to God that we would not return in mass. We would not return like a wall to overtake the land. We were supposed to sit and wait. And this idea of returning, this movement, a political movement, seemed to violate 1,000 years of Jewish tradition of that's not how the redemption is going to happen. And as you know, Jews hold on to their traditions very strongly. Since this didn't fit, they were very opposed to it. The Chov of Eitz Zion had a number of religious leaders, as we've mentioned in the past, but Zionism had very, very few. So it didn't give an aura. Even if you were in favor of the Chov of Eitz Zion, you can hang your hat on quite a number of learned, respected Talmidei Chachamim, Jewish leaders who were in support of the Chov of Eitz Zion. When Herzl comes and starts this World Zionist Congress, it was so secular, the religious leadership never really joined in. There were three of note, which I put here in the notes, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Lushiskin, who was very involved in the founding of the Jewish National Fund and the Jewish Agency, Rabbi Yaakov Yitzchak Reines, who was a Talmud, a student of the Yeshiva Volozhin, the great Yeshiva Volozhin. He's the founder of the Mizrahi movement in 1909, after he leaves the original movement. Again, after about 10 years of the Zionist movement, he then forms the Mizrahi movement, the religious Zionist movement. And Rabbi Udalei Fishman, who's going to found the famous publishing house, the Mossad of Rav Kook, he's actually going to serve as the minister of religion in the first government. So there were a few whose names should be mentioned, but overall, it was not at all a religious movement, and it just didn't seem to fit that this is what we've been waiting for. There is a second major concern that the religious community had, and that is that this movement would actually turn into its own religion, that the Zionist political movement would become a religion unto itself, and it would replace Torah and God as that which defines the Jewish people, and replace that with this culture, this new culture. And that was something which the religious community fought fiercely for, because for 2,000 years of exile, what made us a people, what bound us together, was a shared experience at Har Sinai, accepting the Torah, revelation of God's presence, and adherence to its laws through thick and thin. And we'd been through it all, but at the center of our world was Torah and Hashem. And this movement, again, even though the idea of the love of the Jew, of the land of Israel, is as old as Avram Avinu, but this movement was shifting the focus and saying the return to the land is a end of itself. That is what we are. We're Zionists. No, we're Jews. No, we're Zionists. And there was a fear that would actually take over and redefine what it meant to be a Jew. I actually came across such a person. I remember when I heard this, I was so taken aback. About 10 years ago, I went on a tour when I was living in Atlanta. We took a group of people to Israel. We went on a tour all over the place. And one of the places we went to was very, very northern tip of the land of Israel, on one of those mountaintops where you need special vehicles to go because they have to be protected and it's like not so safe. And we took a group up there, and you're on the hilltop literally looking over Lebanon or Syria. I can't remember exactly which way we were facing. And we had one of the people live on the kibbutz up there, a man, an American in his 60s or 70s, was guiding us and showing us everything. And as he sat us down on the hilltop, he said, wave and smile, everyone. And we're like, okay. And he says, the Lebanese, their machine guns are pointed at you and they're watching you, so make sure you smile at them because they're watching everything that you're doing. Which didn't make any of us feel any more comfortable. But he wasn't afraid at all. And he basically described to us that he was bit by the Zionistic bug when he was in his 20s and whatever it was, in the 60s in Chicago or something. And he like picked up, he left his family, he moved to this hilltop, which at the time was literally a deserted hilltop. And he said, I'm going to defend this piece of land with my life. I've been here for 40 years. I'm never leaving. I will die on this hilltop. Naturally, or by a gunshot, I don't know, I don't care, this is where I'm going to die. He was like, he was so impassioned by it. And then he looks at it, we were a religious group, and he says, you guys are religious, huh? And we're like, yes, 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 and you know, I couldn't hide myself. And he says, this is my religion. He literally used those words. This is my religion. I'm protecting this land, I'm developing this land, and I'm going to die in this land, and I'm a religious person too. That's literally how he defined himself. Now, kol hakavod to him. But you can't change Judaism. Judaism defines being observant or religious as following Torah and mitzvot. Part of that is living in the land of Israel. Part of that is loving the land of Israel, yearning to return to the land of Israel. But that's not it. So there was a fear as this was getting started that that would actually become that. And that was a well-founded fear. They were not making up that concern. At the Second Zionist Congress in 1898, they actually officially adopted a program of promoting a new culture to create the new Jew. The development of camps, of schools. The movement was get the Jews out of the exile and recreate the new Jew. As we spoke about, this was the Haskalah, the Enlightened movement, the Assimilated movement. This was not just a return and a state. It was going to be a new Jew. And what had happened is that Zionism hijacked what was intrinsically a religious idea. God gave the Jewish people this land and said, this is where you'll find me. They hijacked it, cloaked it in a very practical and secular garb, and removed Jewish law, removed connection to God, and was redefining the Jewish people. Imagine if you were there in the early 1900s, late 1800s, and you're a Jew living in exile, and for whatever reason, there's no way that you're going to get to Israel. That's not practical for you, as it is still 100 years later for many of us. And now there's this movement that's saying there's a new Jew in town and it's about being in Israel. And you've been a Jew and your father's Jew and grandfather and father's father for hundreds of years and you can't go there. Thinking like, what do you mean? I'm not a Jew anymore? The Jew is now, the only one who's a Jew is he who's living in Israel and we're going to redefine. What about these hundreds of years of sacrifice to observe Torah and keep mitzvot? And this didn't fit. That we're going to redefine and get rid of all of that. That's what got us here. It didn't get us here just to be a bridge that you could throw it all away. And now that you made it to back to land, it just didn't work. That was a tremendous concern that they had. And there was a third concern, and that was an unspoken concern, but was under the surface and undeniable. And that was the messianic nature of this movement. It was a return home. And even though Herzl himself never claimed to be a Messiah, didn't believe in the Messiah, and wasn't interested. He was just interested in a practical solution to a problem. The masses of Jews who joined together, certainly the religious ones, and again, they weren't of enormous numbers, but those who did saw in this divine mechanisms to restore the ancient people of Israel to their ancient land. This is part of a supernatural redemption. And that was scary to the religious community because nothing about this movement fit as a redemptive process. Nothing. It was irreligious, anti-religious. The leader had no knowledge of Judaism from a religious perspective. So it reeked of false messianism. Now, we've had, historically speaking, many such instances, and all of them end in disaster. So the concept of this return, a movement back, which didn't fit any of the boxes that we were waiting for all these 2,000 years, there was this, oh no, we've been through this before. There's this enigmatic, energetic, charismatic leader bringing people back, and beware. Now, interestingly, again, Herzl never claimed to be the Messiah, but his biographers note that he was often called a Messiah and didn't shy away from the adulation and compliments. And, you know, he was a human being like the rest of us. And so these three are the main concerns. And so the religious community really doesn't join together. Now, they've formed together. The Reform community didn't like them. The Bundes didn't like the Zionists. The religious community didn't like the Zionists. But the Zionists are getting together and having Congress after Congress for many years along the way. Now, it's interesting just to note, it's just a fascinating aspect of this story, that within the Orthodox world, within all of these concerns, three very different groups of Orthodox Jews developed in terms of how they responded to the Zionist movement. Again, there are these three major concerns. It's messianic, it is anti-religious, doesn't seem to fit, it becomes a religion unto its own. Everybody shared those concerns, but they were different groups as to, okay, well, now what? How do we address this? And I've shared this little mashal, this parable once before, but I think it's worth just sharing it again to understand. Again, put yourself in 1900. The World Zionist Congress has now met 3 years. Unclear where it's going and what it's going to look like. And you have all of these concerns as a religious Jew. I share the following parable. There once was a king. There once was a king who had a prince who he saw was going to be the heir to the crown. But the prince had a couple of shortcomings, and they would come up regularly as he was growing up. And the king understood that the prince needed to learn a little bit about what it was going to be like to run the country. He wasn't ready. So the king exiles the prince from the palace and says, "You're going to go out there, son. You're going to learn what it's like to live. And when you're ready, I'm going to call you back, and you're going to take over the kingdom." And the king promises his prince, as he exiles him, he says, "There's work you need to do, but when you're done, I'm going to bring you back. And when you come back, I am going to have the most beautiful bride to be your princess awaiting you. She is going to be beautiful inside and outside. She's going to be capable. She's going to be talented. She's going to help you run this country, and she's going to grow with you. And she is going to be absolutely everything of your dreams inside and out, ready for you." Prince is exiled, and he starts going through all the different work that he needs to do to be ready to take over the kingdom. He's there, he's waiting. Father doesn't call him. All of a sudden, he gets a knock on his door one day in the exile, and a messenger comes from the king's court and says, "Your father just took deathly ill. You need to come home quick to see him before he dies." Prince runs home. It's too late. His father has died. Prince is sitting in the palace. His father's no longer here. He's all by himself. He doesn't know what to do. He gets a knock on the door, and a woman walks in. The woman is the most unseemly, unsightly, unattractive woman he could have ever imagined in his entire life. Seems incompetent, can't even walk straight, put one shoe on after that. Like, just a mess in every way. And she says, "Your father, before he died, chose me to be your bride. Are you ready to get married?" So you're the prince. He looks at this woman. He says, "I don't understand. My father promised me this. Beautiful inside and outside and capable and talented. She was going to help me run. You can barely string two sentences together. There's no way that my father chose you to be my bride." That's what the prince is thinking. Except he has one problem. He says to himself, "How did this woman know to say that to me? That's such a strange thing that this woman would come in and say, 'Your father,' how did she even know to claim? She's clearly not the stuff that my father promised me, but how did she even know what? This is strange." Now, as my story goes, the prince has a couple of options. What are his options in this scenario? Option number one is to say, "I don't know how you knew how to say that, but you're an imposter. I know you're an imposter because my father gave me a detailed description of what was awaiting me when I came home, and you're not it. Without question, you're not it. So get out." Not only would he say get out, but if he's right that she's an imposter, what does she really deserve? Off with her head, trying to be an imposter like that and try to marry and impersonate my father like that. Not just get out, but you're guilty of the death penalty. That's one option. The other extreme would be to say, "I don't know, this doesn't make any sense to me, but the fact that you knew to say that, my father must have said this to you, so here goes, let's get married. Maybe he knows something I trust in him that I don't understand or I don't know. Let's give this a go." That's the other extreme. And the third option is to say, "I don't know what's going on over here, but I'll tell you what. I can't figure this out. I'm not going to marry you, but I'm going to give you a room in the palace. You live there for a little bit. Let's see how this goes. I'll give you a year or two or three. I'll give you some training, set you up with some teachers, see what becomes of you. It's too strange to me that you knew to say that, but you're not what you're supposed to be. I'm not going to throw you out. I'm not going to marry you. Let's wait and see what happens. Let's see if we can make this into something that this can work. This is my crude parable that I made up on my own. It's not perfect. Are the three responses of the religious community to the birth of Zionism. On the one extreme, and this still exists today, were a group of Jews who said, this is an imposter. We have a checklist of what we've been davening for 2,000 years, of what redemption will look like, what the state of Israel will look like when redemption comes. And it's a religious state. It's founded on Yiras Shamayim, on fear of heaven, love of Torah and mitzvos. And this is not it. And if it's not it, but it's claiming to be the state of Israel, it's an imposter. And we need to do everything in our power to rid ourselves of this imposter so that the true bride can come. Now, today, there are very few groups that still adhere to this. You'll see them protesting on Israeli parades, groups of Hasidim holding signs with the Palestinians. They're a fringe today, a small group who believe that the modern state of Israel is evil, is an imposter, and must be gotten rid of in order for true redemption to happen, and who believe that as long as it's still here, redemption will never happen. Right, but in the early 1900s, that wasn't a small fringe group, because we live in hindsight. We see the state of Israel and what's happening. But at the time, this was a very strange marriage for a religious Jew to join in the Zionist movement with all of its anti-religious, secular, no God Torah part of the equation to join in. That was one group that was much stronger in the early days. The other extreme saw this as, if this is what God is doing, jump in and marry the girl. God knows what he's doing best. So he sent us what seems to be a strange form of redemption. How do you want? It's not up to us. I mentioned this last week. This thought is promoted by Rav Kook that said, who are we to question God's ways? If this is how he wants redemption to happen, this is how redemption is going to happen. Are you jumping in or are you not jumping in? You don't want to be left behind when the train leaves the station for redemption. Okay, you thought the train would be going in a different direction and would look a little bit differently, but this is the train. Hop on. And there was a marriage to the movement in a redemptive quality. That when we speak a little bit more about Rav Kook, who really saw in this all of the redemptive things, which 120 years later seem to be coming true, much slower than he envisioned, but along that way. And there was a third group that basically said, let's wait and see. I don't want to marry you yet, but maybe we can give you a place to stay. We'll live near each other. And maybe we could develop. Maybe the relationship can change. Maybe you'll learn the traits that you need. And there was an ability, an attempt to influence. And some of the religious Jews, and within that, there are really several other flavors than the three that I mentioned. Some within that middle flavor, there were some that engaged more than others. Some that the religious Zionist movement came about by saying, okay, this is what we have. Let's join in and try to influence it as much as we can and make it into a religious state, a religious place to live. There was more of a Haredi approach which said, this isn't redemption, but treat it like any other government. It's a place to live. If we can live here and observe Torah and keep the mitzvos here better than somewhere else, let's do it. It's great to be in the land of Israel. It's a special place. Doesn't mean we have to embrace the state. It just means that this is a secular government, and the same way that we dealt with the Russian government, however we can get away with not dealing with them as best we can, just try to keep focus on what we want to do, we'll do in Israel too. And you have groups like that still today who are happy to live there. They just don't acknowledge the state. Not that it's evil, just that it's a state. If a Jew lived in America, you got to deal with the government. We got to deal with the government. I don't view this as my government. I'm living here. And all these different approaches of what do we do in this example where none of this fits the way that it's supposed to fit, but it's here. Do we all out marry the girl? Do we reject? do we live next door and see if we could figure out a way to make this work? And that has really followed through. I gave you some sources here. We're not going to read through all of them as the hour is late. The first source in section F is a ad that was placed in the New York Times in 1994, which very much expresses that first anti-Zionist approach, that this entire endeavor is evil and must be done away with. And you could see this was a full-page ad placed in the New York Times, which expresses that this is not true. It's not redemption. It's an imposter, and we really need to remove ourselves from it. Again, today, that's pretty much a fringe group that still believes that. You'll find a couple of Munkach Hasidim or Satmar Hasidim, the Turikarta are the main groups that still adhere to that approach, but this is where it's founded from. You can bring a source on the top of page 4, you see, when the spies come back in the Torah itself, and Hashem decrees that there's going to be 40 years of wandering in the desert, and this entire generation is not going to enter into the land. The Torah describes that as the people mourn, hearing this word, that they're not going to make it into the land of Israel, they arose early in the morning and ascended to the mountain, saying, "We're ready to go to the place that Hashem had spoken. We've been sinners, we're ready to go." And Moshe says, "It's too late. Don't go. Hashem is not with you. You will fall by the sword." And they said, "We're going. We want it. Hashem gave it to us." And they go up the mountain, the Torah says. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites came down and they smite them with their sword and crush them and pursue them out. And Jews over the centuries in the last 100 years said, "If it's not the right time, it's not the right time." That's one approach. And then you have, of course, the religious Zionist supporters, the Mizrahi. They saw it, some saw it in messianic terms, some saw it just to join together and see if we could influence it. And it's expressed, as we mentioned last week as well, of in the middle of page 4, this is a quote from Rav Cook's son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who basically said, "How can it be that there is a movement to return and settle our homeland and religious Jews didn't join together? How can it be that it's not mortals, it's the master of his own house forcing our hand, creating the influence? Look at what he did." Okay, you didn't think it would happen like this, but he did it. How could you not join in and want to be a part of this movement? Okay, so there are many different groups of Jews, and it's important to note that, again, in that era, in the era in which this is born, it is so complicated because we see in hindsight what it became. But there were many voices that had many different ways of looking at what this would do to the Jewish people. Everything is going to change by the Holocaust, of course, in terms of and the actual creation of the state in 1948. But that's 50 years after Herzl begins the World Zionist Congress. Now, to conclude with a little bit of some of Herzl's successes and failures in these early days of political Zionism. He is a master showman. He's tall, he has these piercing eyes, these great black beard, a lot of grace, intelligence, an aura of authority, all those pictures that you see of him. And he, in a decade of work, literally in a decade of work, successfully met many world leaders to negotiate with them for the Jewish people. An unheard of concept before 1896 that someone would meet with a world leader like the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire to discuss the plight of the Jews, to meet with the Kaiser of Germany. This was unheard of, and he did it. Now, almost nothing came of it in terms of practical movement. Almost nothing came of it, but he presented this sense of movement. Things were happening. He met with the Kaiser of Germany, Wilhelm II. He met with him twice, one of them actually in the land of Palestine. A great comment from, he met with the Russian Tsar's Minister of Interior, who was also, not officially, but was the enforcer of all of the pogroms against the Jews. So he meets with him to try to get the Russian Jews, you know, support for this. And the minister says to him, "You're preaching to the converted. We would love for you to create a state where we could get rid of 3 million Jews and send them out of here. Tell us when you're done." But he wasn't much of a help. He was just saying, you know, as soon as you get it done, we'd love to send you our Jews. He met with the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, which reportedly cost him $50,000 in bribes, which was quite a hefty sum in those days, which of course led to nothing. And if anything, some of the historians understand that it was actually hurtful to the Jews because the Ottomans were kinder to the Aguda Jews of Israel at the time, Palestine, they weren't trying to break off and start their own land. They were just trying to be good Ottoman citizens, whereas the Zionists were trying to carve out a Jewish land, an Arab land. That didn't really go so well for the in the Ottoman world. And he met with Pope Pius X as well, who told him, "We cannot give you approval. There is no way the church will ever approve of such a movement. We will not allow Jerusalem. We can't stop you from moving, but we're never going to approve it. But you should know," he said, "if you come back, we will build a church for every Jew that comes back to be able to baptize them. That is my promise to you if you indeed try to bring the Jews back." So he gets really nice. He speaks with these world leaders, but he gets nowhere. So he turns to England, colonial England, who's trying to build this empire. He meets with Rothschild and he meets with Joseph Chamberlain, who was the colonial secretary at the time. And the empire of England, the government, makes him an offer. "We, in their quest to settle as much of the world as they could, will give you a colony in Uganda. You can rule over your own colony. It'll be under British auspices, but under Jewish rule, and you can have that as your homeland." And Herzl accepts, because again, he only accepted the Palestine in the beginning because of the Eastern European Jews who refused to hear anything else. But as far as he was concerned, we just need a place of our own. We need our state. He presents this to the Sixth Zionist Congress in 1903, the proposal to go to Uganda. And as you can imagine, what happens on the floor of the Congress when he makes this proposition, "We're going to Uganda, and that will be the Jewish homeland." So I'm sure there were those who were in favor, and anyone who had any religious backing or any sentiment to history and the Jewish homeland basically said, "There's no way that we can do that." They couldn't come to a resolution, of course, at that Sixth Congress in 1903, and Herzl tables it and says, "We're going to take a vote on it at the Seventh Congress in 1904. His health deteriorates between those two dates, and by the time the World Congress meets in 1904, Herzl has already died. His voice of a Jewish state is then, at that following Congress, far outshouted by the voices of Jewish homeland. It's not enough just to have a state. We need to have a home. And the idea of going to Uganda is basically shot down in his absence by those who were absolutely not hear of it. And again, in one of the other ironies of Jewish history, so the secular movement, which basically hijacked an idea of the return to the homeland, made it secular, so secular that it was actually proposed to go to Uganda. It's like such a historical note that it's almost hard to imagine that the Zionist movement, which we today know and love, proposed going to Uganda. But they did. And it was the religious Jews who took it back and said, absolutely not. And eventually, even though the religious Jews never became the dominant force, but they were enough of a force where the whole idea basically doesn't ever get off the ground. And then the British weren't so clear that they were ever going to carry it through. And that idea basically falls off. But Herzl dies at the age of 44 before the Seventh Congress. He only makes it through the first six. He very prophetically said, as is widely publicized in one of his diaries, that when he convened the first Congress, he said, "Today I founded the Jewish state. You might laugh at me today, but in 50 years you'll see it's a reality." And he was literally just about right on the nose in 1948, almost 50 years to the day of when he originally convened that first Congress. Indeed, the modern state of Israel was born. His personal life is one of unrelieved tragedy. He dies in 1903, again at the young age of 44, and his wife dies just 3 years later in 1907. A large trust fund was established by the Zionist movement, and the family, his surviving family, decided to bypass the Jewish National Fund and Keren HaYesod, which were the actual funds created by the Zionist movement. They said, "Nah, too risky," and they instead put all the money into an Austro-Hungarian Empire trust funds. And the Austro-Hungarian Empire, by the First World War, no longer exists, and the money is absolutely worthless. So the entire fund that was dedicated to his family and descendants literally became worthless. He had three children. His daughter Pauline was sickly, addicted to morphine. She dies childless and alone in 1930. His son Hans, who suffered from mental disorders, was baptized in 1924, and then he comes back to Judaism. But then when his sister Pauline dies in 1930, he commits suicide shortly after her death, also without children. And his younger daughter, Trudy, was killed in a concentration camp by the Germans in 1943, and her only child commits suicide in 1946. So by 1946, 2 years before the birth of the State of Israel, there's not a single descendant of Theodor Herzl alive in the world. But he is nonetheless the founder of the political movement of Zionism. And I think it's always important to state it that way. The concept of loving and returning to the land of Israel not only existed through the not only throughout history, from the literally from Avram Avinu, but there was actually already movements to return in the mid-1800s with the Chovev Etzion. The first Aliyah begins in 1881, 25,000 Jews return, but Herzl is the first to create a political movement, an organization that's going to fight for the development of a Jewish-controlled state. He himself was not married to the idea of it being in Palestine, as we see, but it was, of course, married to Palestine from the various forces that joined in with him. But he was the lightning rod that electrified the Jewish world, brought us together, created the Zionist Congress, put the forces into motion. Of course, the religious Zionists would spin off to do their thing. The revisionist Zionists would spin off. The labor Zionists, the liberal Zionists, the postmodern Zionists, but the idea of a political movement that grabbed the time and said, now is the time to do this, is indeed the heritage that Theodor Herzl gave to the Jewish people. And despite, as all things go, once it was birthed, you know, it goes off in its own direction in many different ways. And still today, it's constantly changing and developing. But there's no question that the movement that he started, the political movement, was a major step along the way for, of course, the birth of the modern state in 1948. And this was a little bit about some of the issues that really just absorbed the Jewish world when it started. The concerns of the religious, of the reform, it was not simple at all. And we again have the hindsight to look back and see. But as it was happening, and I've said this many times, I'll say it publicly. Today, I imagine everybody on this call would be an ardent, proud supporter of the Zionism, and would call themselves a Zionist. If any of us lived in 1940, in 1930, 1920, it was a complicated. No one knew what it was going to become. Rav Kook believed it was redemption; it was divine. But most of the religious world, I mean, literally almost most, looked at it as a threat to observant Judaism. It was so anti-religious. It was so secular. If your child in 1930 said they wanted to be a Zionist, it was equivalent to saying, I don't want to be religious anymore. As a religious Jew, that was a complicated thing to hear. Because there was no way to be a Zionist in religion. It didn't exist. The Mizrahi movement is just getting started. To say that I want to be a Zionist meant to say I don't want to be religious. Doesn't mean that anymore, but it did. And as it gets started, to just appreciate where it got started from and look at where it is now is fascinating over the 100 years of its existing, 120 years. But this movement is of course, the starting point of that. We will continue. We'll take a couple of weeks off. Mirat Hashem will pick up again sometime soon. We'll go back and talk about that first Aliyah in the various Aliyahs that are going to influence the development of the land of Israel and lead to the state of Israel. And thank you all for listening. Enjoy. Have a wonderful night. And we'll meet up again sometime soon. Have a great Hanukkah. All the best, everyone.